You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya, Anthasiakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo.
Hey, you're listening to Sounds Gyaimen, the somewhat irregular radio show brought to you by CITR's LGBTQ plus collective. In light of Black History Month, this episode features the voices of Black Canadians who speak to us a bit about how they live and celebrate their queerness. First off, we have an interview with Dominique Wakeland, aka Mix Bukuru, a drag artist, poet, performance artist, and among many other creative forms. You might have seen them gracing the stage at Man at Vancouver pre-pandemic if you were lucky. Then, we'll meet Mary Lise Haviambury, a UBC student who speaks to us a bit about her coming out experience, the lesbian master dog, and the intersection of being Black and queer. I apologize in advance for my sound quality in this episode. I forgot that I was using my janky headphones that I got from Amazon that were like $10. I don't know why I did that, but I apologize in advance. Thankfully, I do not speak that much, so please bear with me. Here is my interview with Mix Bukuru, aka Dominique Wakeland.
So, hello. would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, my name is Dominique Wakeland. On stage, I go by Mix Bukuru, the church being your mama never wanted you to meet. That's B-U-K-U-R-U. And if you don't know what it means, honey, look it up. Yeah, I would say that I'm a theater artist, poet, and drag performer.
Yeah. I was like looking at your Instagram and I Googled you to research you. And I noticed that you wear a lot of hats as an artist. And I was wondering, like, was there one art form that you started with, or did it just kind of all bleed together?
Yeah, so I started out with poetry, but I think that once you get to a certain point of like poetry and writing and language, performance is just so inherently tied. And then I went into theater. God, I have no idea how to pronounce that. Like, I failed the mid-Atlantic accent. and then I went to school for theater performance at SFU. And then I dabbled with drag during my degree, but I didn't seriously start doing it until post-degree. So like, I would say that like that's the kind of evolution.
What kind of theater did you do at SFU, and then describe the evolution?
Yeah, so the type of theater that I did at SFU was not stuff you would bring your uncle to see. But like my uncles, my aunties, my mom, my dad, they did support me. Did they ever really understand what was going on stage? No, but there was support. So SFU specializes in devised theater, which has a lot of elements of performance creation. And I would say like the three-act Aristotelian play-act structure is like not what you're gonna get at a show. It's just not that level, like that type of text analysis is not it. You're gonna get a lot of movement theater. You're gonna get a lot of like people maybe eating raw meat on stage. And I think like that better prepared me for like for cabaret and drag than anything else. Oh, because I did do burlesque before I did drag. And then I was like, no, I want to be more explicit about my gender performance.
Mm. Did you ever have to eat meat on stage yourself?
No, actually. So I was in this one, God, bless. God bless gay men that don't realize when they're objectifying women. I was in this one production of this adaptation of Bluebeard's castle, and there was a lot of like different fruits on stage that were eventually like thrown around, like, and like expensive fruits and stuff. I think, what's the strangest thing I've done on stage? Oh, I was in this production that was about sex positivity. It was not produced in a sex positive way, let me tell you.
Oh, no.
But there was this one scene where we covered someone in like a really thin layer of like body clay, thin enough that they stood at the back of the stage for two scenes, and then like two scenes in, it had dried. So like they, when they started moving, it was this really stunning appearance of them like as a statue coming to life.
Whoa.
Yeah. Horrendous process, but beautiful images.
The aesthetics are there. Was this the play directed by a gay man?
Oh, that one was like a student production, and that one was Bluebeard.
Oh.
The Nymph was directed by a white woman.
I saw that you were an artist in residence at What Lab last year in 2020?
Oh, okay, actually. That's a series of emails that I haven't returned because of COVID. But so the residency was canceled. Not mm-hmm. like What Lab is great, so active. I was so excited to like be diving in and doing that like research into exotification on stage, like what is divaness, and like really delving, like really exploding some cultural concepts. Mm-hmm. And then COVID.
Oh no.
Yeah. Yeah. So like sometimes I literally even forget that I had a residency that was going to happen.
Yeah. But the panoramic got to it before you did.
Yeah, that panini though.
The placenta, and I cannot get over it. We are in a paragraph right now.
We are in a plane. We're in a Boeing plane.
I still wanted to ask you about like the ideas that you wanted to explore, like mm-hmm. gay minstrel and internet blackface.
So the purpose of that like, do you watch a lot of drag?
Not a lot. I'm also very new at being queer.
That's lovely. That's stunning. This will be great for you. So you're new to queerness.
Yeah.
This will be like something really interesting for you to clock.
Mm.
Okay. There are white queens that play with ideas of whiteness, and then there are white queens that, because Black queer community is so tied to ballroom, to drag, like, and so much of the vernacular is enmeshed,
mm-hmm.
you sometimes get these like white queens that don't realize they're parodying Blackness and profiting off of being white while parodying Blackness. Like Trixie Mattel and Katya, those are white. Okay, so Trixie is not technically white, but I would say she engages in whiteness in her performance presentation. So those are white queens that are white. That, like, Katya's whole stick is that she's like Russian. She very bendy. She like there's this different. So those are like two white queens that I can watch, and I never feel Like, even when they're like, yes, queen, honey, work. They're not like, yes, queen, honey, work. Like, there's not that slide mm-hmm. into it that is, like, culturally acceptable. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, sometimes, I mean, like, Laganja Estranja, if you're making your way through, like, all the RuPaul, you notice, like, there's that big blowout they have where I think Adore is like, you don't talk like this at home. Like, you are coming out with, like, all these, like, yes, queen, like, you're, and Adore's just like, you don't talk like this at home. I don't know who this is. Mm-hmm. And Laganja in that sense was really, like, parried, like, imitating blackness and, like, trying to bring out her inner diva mm-hmm. on a like, national stage, international, really. So, and like, Alma Bitches is a local white queen. Mm-hmm. Whenever local white thing, I think Alma is non-binary, but I'm not sure what pronouns they use to describe, like, their drag persona now. Mm-hmm. Local Alma Bitches is a local drag performer, mm-hmm. and like, when they're hosting, they might do like a yes, but it's not like a yeah, like, it's there's like all these differences that, like, you can really clock when someone is starting to imitate, like, blackness in their performance, because there's this cultural idea of the diva.
Hi, team.
We should, we'll be moving downstairs. Sorry,
okay.
We're not waking you, we'll be
out here in a few minutes. Okay, so there's this cultural idea of the diva, mm-hmm. and I mean, it's your Beyonce, it's your Rihanna, it's your Nicki, but it's also your Madonna, and it's also your Liza Minnelli, and it's your Cher, and it's like all these cultural, icons, but like, sometimes when someone performs, they'll be like, I'm gonna summon my inner Beyonce, and what I wanted to explore in the residency was like the new minstrel, which is something that you kind of see mutate in cabaret, mm-hmm. because there are these like signifiers in performance of divadom, mm-hmm. and of like, yeah, there are these signifiers in performance of divadom, and like how, and for a lot of them are like linked to race, or at least to me, and it was also like investigating that, and like whether or not anything that I'm saying right now is just complete and utter like bull hooky, because when I, like, you just, you know it when you see it. Mm-hmm. Like, Lily Singh imitates blackness for a living. Mm-hmm. We know that. We've seen it. It's very noticeable. And in that same sense, you can clock drag queens who are, like, imitating it and getting away with it because of, like, whiteness. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm light-skinned. Like, I know that if I like go further into cultural perceptions of blackness, I make more money, and that's just like cold hard facts, baby. Like, so it's investigating that idea of like what the audience still expects us to do on stage, mm-hmm. And like what is rewarded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have noticed a lot of like white gay men like speaking like Black women, mm-hmm. With all of those like things you said, and I never really thought about how that could translate into the drag community where it's so much more heightened and so much more visible, mm-hmm. and no one is ever having these conversations because we love drag queens and the audience, you know, as woke as they are, we're not going to call them out, and I think we should talk about that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, and there's certain stages in Vancouver actually where like white queens are not allowed to like lip sync Black artists, and there's pushback against that, but I also think it's like really nice that there's one stage.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's one room you can go into and you're not gonna watch it, and like they might end up imitating like divadom, like, and like imitating like Blackness to their like doula peep mm-hmm. lip sync, but like you're not gonna have to watch them mutilate Cupcake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh god, there should be more stages like that.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting conversation. Okay, last year I went on stage during a VNDS number. So like the coaches assigned songs, and one of them, so like one of my friends was assigned a song by Tina Turner, it was Proud Mary. And there was, and like, so like I came on stage and interrupted the number. And then like kind of like gave them some inspo into like how to do it. And then I kind of, and then I basically upstaged them. And they got some flack for the judges. They got some flack from the judges for that. And then like one of the judges who is Black disagreed with it being a like song of like Black cultural disagreed with the concept, because they just saw it as like a people song and not a Black song. Like Formation is a Black song by Beyonce. Like we know Formation is a Black song. If you're a white person lip syncing it, I really don't know what to tell you. Like I can't help you at that point. But we had a conversation not on stage that was really like good, but I think it's, to me it's just like the entitlement of access.
Mm-hmm.
And like questioning that interests me really. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And like taking a pause and being like, oh, you have like access to these spaces and like this is the songs you're choosing to do in them because your like corporation doesn't want to pay for like anybody darker than Milk Toast to like get up on stage, and you feel comfortable like lip syncing Black songs in those spaces. Like that's astonishing to me. Yeah, I just think it's a larger conversation, and it really is like a case by case basis, but it's also like, yeah, the sense of entitlement is I think what really gets me
for sure. Yeah. One of the broader topics that we were trying to explore like throughout the run of this year's collective, and also especially this episode, is like trying to deconstruct the whitewashing of queer history, mm-hmm. And the overrepresentation of whiteness in queer media, when a lot of like trailblazing work and culture of the queer community has been done by like Black trans activists and artists. And it's kind of interesting that you mentioned this, because even though whiteness is overrepresented, they're definitely feeling entitled, and they always fall back on Black culture, and they appropriate that.
Mm-hmm.
So Black people are doing all the work and white people are being the face of it.
Yeah. And it's like every culture feels entitled to Blackness. I mean, mm-hmm. like when, like California, you have like a high South, in California, you have like a high Southeast Asian population due to like forced migration, due to like pattern, like due to, what's it called? I got nothing, but you have like a high, like you have really dense neighborhoods of like predominantly like Filipino or Chinese neighborhoods, like directly next to Black neighborhoods. And what you get is like Chinese kids that think it's okay to say the N-word. And like very specific like methods of talking, but like it doesn't go the same way. That reciprocity of the culture is the reciprocity of like the use of slurs is not the same way. Let's be real. I mean, I think you do see some like you see like cross-pollination in terms of like Wu-Tang Clan. Like grew up on a specific type of movie, draws inspiration from like that cultural imagery. But like I would still say it's very different than like kids that think it's okay to cornrow because their neighbor cornrows and like that's who they've grown up around. But like the Black kids have grown up around them, and so the sexualization of the kipao, I think it's kipao, not kuipao, right?
I don't know.
The dress. Like, you know, like the collar dress, like the silk brocade.
I thought it was called a chong sam. Maybe that's another dress.
Okay.
But I know what you're talking about.
Right. But like that, so one, the sexualization of it is like a problem. And I just distinctly remember, like, maybe it was a couple of years ago on Twitter, but this one Black girl, like this one dark-skinned Black woman getting absolutely like destroyed online for like posting a picture wearing one. Mm-hmm. And I just like think of, like Lily Singh, where did she do? She grew up in Toronto, and it's, and like all of her defenses for her videos is just like, well, that's just how we talk in the neighborhood. And it's like, really, Lily? Really, Lily? You don't talk that way to your parents. I know you don't. I know you don't. Like the Blackness that you imitate and profit off of is because of your like proximity, because you're not Black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're inherently more palatable.
Yeah. Man, I'm just thinking about the like the replies of that to that tweet of that Black woman wearing the Chinese dress. And yeah. I feel like instances like that is like when boba communism, like commieism pops off, just like a bunch of Asian, East Asian people who like otherwise don't really care about politics, just being like, this is bad representation of the Asian community. Like mm-hmm. where you're kind of shifting gears. I wanted to ask you about like how you got started like performing at Man Up. Mm-hmm. I've only been once, like last year, because that's when I was sort of exploring my queerness more, and I really miss it, but it's been like the most special going out experience where queer bodies were so visible and celebrated in a way that I've never seen in Vancouver, at least during the day. I feel like I never see that, and it's like, wow, where has this been? Like I feel like I had to really like go looking for it, but I wanted to ask if you felt like the queer community in Vancouver is something that you had to search for or like know the right people for, or something that you found.
Oh, you have to know the right people. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. I'm not gonna like sit here and say, oh, it's inherently welcoming. You'll automatically be like welcomed in, but like welcoming looks a lot of different ways, you know, like is the support like does it look like someone checking in to make sure you got the invite, or does it look like you just subscribing to their Facebook page? Does it like does it look like culturally specific events that are now, I would say, more popping off? You see a lot like the development of Pride in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. So, and like the House of Rice and those events, like you have really taken a long time to build and are like beautiful. And like that community, they do a lot of specific outreach to community members to like make sure that people are coming.
Okay.
So I'm not going to lie to you and say that it's easy. In fact, and I'm gonna tell this story because Paige, who is like one of the producers of Man Up, I would say that like we're now co-collaborators on a couple of different projects, and like I think they know that I respect them. But the first time I had any experience, like I had any exposure to Man Up, I emailed to like do the amateur show because like they, in like the post that I saw on Facebook, and this was years ago, like I think this might've been 20, God, that would have been 2014, 2015. Whoa.
Like 8 years ago.
Whoa. So the first time I emailed them, it was because they were offering like culturally specific mentorship, because it was the amateur hour and you could like ask for help for choreo. And I think they were like starting to really realize that like the way like white supremacy was enacted in their spaces, like on a subconscious level. So like I was very much like, yeah, I would really love to like talk to like a Black artist, blah, 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 blah. And that email that I also like followed up on it, like it got lost, I guess. So like a week before the event, they were like, oh yeah, did you still want to do this? And of course I said no. Like, I didn't want to like go up on stage and be awful and messy.
Yeah.
So like after that, it took a while for me actually to, would have been 2017. And then I went to their, they had a big show at the Rickshaw, and I went to, and I went because I was doing research for a play that I dramaturged, like assistant dramaturged, called Big Queer Filipino Karaoke Night. And the main, it was a one person show, and it was like a drag artist hosting a karaoke night. Mm-hmm. So we were doing research into drag and specifically like what it looked like in the city. So yeah. And then the next time I went to a Man Up show was at the big show at the Rickshaw. And I think the only reason I started going to like drag again was because I saw Rose Butch and the performance they did with, it was with two other performers. I think it was Rin and someone else. Rin's not their drag name. I cannot remember their drag name. Yeah, so like I it's not easy. Like, and most of my formative memories on Davie Street were just of like being made to feel like fat and undesirable, and like I am. And when I was on Davie Street to like get those memories, I was like a size 6 or 8. Like I was thin. But so like Man Up as a space has been really like great because like there's just so much more body diversity. And at the warehouse space, Mr. Fish Inc. was commissioned to make this like absolutely fucking stunning mural. I don't know, did you see it? The one with all the pinks and the purples and the people?
Oh, I haven't.
It's, oh my God, you look at that and you're like, I would like to exist in that illustration. I would like to exist in that painting. I would like to exist in that mural. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I would say commercial drag, which is a show that might start happening like monthly again, but not for a while, is like the show that I really felt community from.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that's like a larger, like so much of queer existence is just like pushed to nightlife. It's the only time that we have the space to be ourselves. But it also means that like, yeah, it also means that like, if you're not interested in partying, like how do you start to form community and mutual aid? And like, how do you really build those connections? And it's not easy. Vancouver is inherently an unwelcoming like place unless you know the right people, and finding those people is just, God, it can take, how long did it take me? It took me 5 years.
Wow. Yeah. And you're not from, I feel like it's so much harder for people who aren't from the city of Vancouver too.
So I'm from Vancouver. Mm. Like I grew up in Surrey, mm-hmm. you know, GVRD, woohoo. But yeah, I've never lived downtown, and it is a different, like, there is a solid queer core of like people that live on Main Street or live downtown or live in the Village. Like there's just all these like, they are different. They are different groups.
Okay. And that kind of leads me to my final question, which is, are there any memorable moments from Black History Month, past and present of yours that you wanted to share?
Mm-hmm. Are there? I think for me, this Black History Month has really been so different. Like last year, I was booked to the point of exhaustion. Like if there was a stage, they wanted me on it because I was one of like four Black drag performers in the city. And they wanted me at the party, mama. They wanted me there. And at the end of the month, I had a whole bunch of thoughts. And I was very much like, I think next year what I'm gonna do is, if you haven't booked me for the last 6 months, then I'm gonna put a $50 surcharge that you're like using my image to like you're profiting off of my image in that sense. And then COVID, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say this year, my Black History Month is like much less busy. but it's nice because like, I think I feel less pressure.
Mm-hmm.
There's this like constant capitalistic race of like, well, if you're Black, you better be doing something for Black History Month because one, it'll get your branding out. You'll maybe go viral. Like two, what's the two? Really, but like in my bio, and it's always been in my bio, is every month is Black History Month, baby. And that's what I do. I bring pieces of Black, like I have this one, it's one of my favorite, and I have this one piece I do about John Ware, who was like a Black cowboy in what's colonially known as Alberta. And like I make the audience like sing this song with me just to like presence him in the room and like remember his name. And I really don't think the first time I did that number was in Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I like dread the month of February.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
it's overwhelming and like the cynicism is there. But mm-hmm. Last year I did perform at the Black Futures Gala for BLM Vancouver, and it was a majority Black room. And like I got to do the stuff that I wanted to do, and like it was just fun. Yeah. And at no point did anyone like think that I was aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Just being Black with other Black people and not performing it for non-Black people, that must be very freeing.
Yeah, and like those are the spaces that I like. I don't actually particularly enjoy talking about Blackness in February. Like I don't want to be asked my opinion on racism. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. So it's, I'm gonna wait a little bit, just a second. And that's not me saying that Black History Month shouldn't exist, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, it exists for a very real reason and should be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
It's an exhausting month unless you like choose to center what you want out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Now the patriarchy is dead, and we killed it. If you identify as a woman, femme, trans, or non-binary, CITR wants you on the air. You can talk about literally whatever you want as long as you care about it. No worries if you have no experience, we'll train you in everything you need to know. Come by CITR and say hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday to help us never play Led Zeppelin on CITR 101.9 FM ever again.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What does Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Xenia!
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Nisiyem, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyem, Nisiyaya, Anthasyakhuya, Talitin, Homasque, Mustail.
What is up? You're listening to the Queer Collective on CITR Radio. This month, we have the honor and the privilege to discuss the topics relating to Black Canadians for Black History. My name is William, and I rent my body. I'm joined today by Marylise Habiyambere. They are a queer Rwandan Canadian poet, activist, and Lauren Scholar. Wow. They're also a psychology student at the University of British Columbia. She's passionate about women's rights, yoga, and building meaningful connections. She's also an outreach volunteer at the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center and a volunteer coordinator at the UBC Yoga Club. How's it going, Mary?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. It is sunny. My mental health is definitely much better when it's sunny. Could you tell our audience a little bit about yourself that you haven't already spoken to?
Yeah, sure. So I'm currently in Vancouver, but I'm not originally from here. I'm really interested in understanding people and understanding myself as well. Psychology has definitely helped me see where the sources of some of my behavior in my relationships in life, understanding my family dynamics, my friendship dynamics. So it has really contributed a lot to my self-development. So that's why I really like psychology. And
that's so great. You mentioned also in your bio that you are an outreach volunteer at the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center. What's that like for you? What's your favorite thing about working?
I really like the people. It's a really supportive community, and I feel like we're all like-minded and enjoy each other's company. And despite how heavy the subject matter is and sort of the experiences that we're exposed to, it's very rewarding and has contributed to my understanding of feminism, which is very much intersectional. So really understanding how our intersecting identities differentiate our experiences and the importance of having an intersectional lens on things like sexualized violence, because it's very much a disproportionate issue that people face of all genders. So yeah.
I forgot to ask your pronouns. How do you identify, by the way?
I identify as she, her.
She, her. When we were talking earlier, but when you were talking to Gian, you described yourself as a self-described baby queer. What does that mean to you? I guess like for a lot of us at the collective, we've discussed feeling similarly, where we're like the idea of like not being gay or having the space to nurture our queerness. What does being baby queer mean to you? And how does that play into what you just talked about with intersectionality?
That's a good question. And I kind of want to start by talking about my coming out experience.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, it was definitely an emotionally draining, quite traumatic experience. I came out the summer after first year. I was away at the time. I was interning in Nova Scotia, and I'm really grateful for that distance. I think I would have had a much harder time coping and working through that experience coming out to my parents. And yeah, I sort of came out unwillingly. I had put on a pride filter on my Facebook profile, sort of without context, and my dad texted me asking me about it, sort of confronting me on why I did that, and you know, asking me if I was part of that community. And I was definitely very defensive at first. I was saying I was trying to show solidarity, that it didn't mean anything. And the more my dad interrogated me about it, the more I felt, okay, I can't just like ignore this. I have to come out. So I said that I was bisexual, and my dad did not take that very well. And my mom and my dad were pretty disappointed by that news, and, you know, were saying that the media was influencing me and that this went against God's will. And
well, I definitely got that before.
Yeah, was unnatural because I had grown up in a Christian household. Like, my parents were pretty religious. I went to church. I was baptized. I went to Sunday school. So
you watch me too.
That is a common theme. It's a yeah. And that definitely contributed to my internalized homophobia, just not being able to process my sexuality or even considering that I might not be straight. So that was really intense. But I'm glad I did it, because it was like this huge weight lifted off of me. And I was able to work through that by reflecting and talking to my supervisor at the nonprofit I was working at. Was really nice. And I remember him telling me that, like, my parents would come around and, like, not believing him. And my parents did end up coming around, although it's still not this fully loving acceptance, but it's not a, you know, it's not emotional. It's not like they are pushing any sort of belief on me now. So there has been progress. And also talking about it with other people who I knew in my life who were queer helps a lot too. But I still found myself after that summer just still shrinking to appease my parents, because I knew, you know, they told me to just focus on my academics and my involvements and let time figure things out for me, because, you know, they thought it was a phase and I would just, you know, get over it or something. And I sort of played into it because, you know, we all sort of seek our parents' approval, and I still struggle with that, like being okay with the fact that how I want to live my life won't always be in agreement with my parents. So I was still not fully living as a queer person in second year. And yeah, I sort of let that go on for most of second year. But then I started going to therapy, and I realized that I had let so much anger build up inside of me that I was neglecting towards my parents, and just having to compromise parts of myself so that others could be more comfortable. And yeah, therapy has been a really important part in working through that anger and just becoming less focused on what other people think I should be, and asking myself who I want to be and what being my authentic self looks like. So I definitely recommend therapy. I mean, it's not accessible to everyone. I do think it is becoming more accessible, but therapy has helped me so much in just becoming more of myself. And actually, two other things that sort of contributed to why I didn't completely retreat away when my parents were confronting me during my coming out experience was I had taken this philosophy course called Existentialism.
Ooh.
Yes, and it just made me realize that I couldn't live my life for other people, and that I had to walk away from that. I had to stop living from a distance to myself, because I sort of put on this projection. I was putting on this projection of who, you know, I thought other people wanted me to be, and I convinced myself that it was me, and it just forced me to really think about what kind of life I want to live, and authenticity, and what isn't authentic. And, you know, it's just a waste of time to live your life in a way that isn't a true reflection of who you are. So that was a really important course for me to take. And then also in my first year, I had this major crush on this girl. And it like sort of like took me by surprise, because I didn't think it would happen again. I had previously like had a crush on this girl in high school, a very close friend. And I was like, oh, this is like a, I don't know. I came up with all these strange explanations as to why I liked them and why it broke my heart when they didn't reciprocate those feelings, and how it was just like this is very specific to this person. Like, it's not going to happen again. But then it did. And then I was like, okay, now I need to really address my sexuality. Like, I couldn't keep running from it. So, yeah. And yeah, like I said, it's still a work in progress. Like, I'm very much a baby queer. I embrace and pull away from my queerness, sort of like in this endless cycle. I'm just being uncertain. And I mean, sexuality is a very confusing thing.
No, definitely.
To understand and figure out what label works for you. And sometimes I think, like, am I constricting myself by trying to label who I am, and thinking, like, am I really attracted to men? And, you know, does dating men make me less queer? And just, it's just a lot of, like, you know, thigh erasure definitely plays into that. And yeah, it's a really complicated thing. And actually this, just before this, I was reading the Lesbian Master Doc. I don't know if you come across that.
Oh, you need to send that to me. Ooh,
oh my God.
I love that.
I'm surprised you haven't, because it's this huge thing that people have been circling around. And in it, it talks about this thing called compulsory heterosexuality. And, you know, really asking, like, is your attraction to men based on this need for male validation? Is it about conforming?
Yes.
Is it about conforming to society's expectations? So it asks a lot of really interesting questions. And yeah, I don't know why it took me this long, because I had heard of the Master Doc, but I hadn't really given it like a chance to really read through it. But I was just like having this realization that it's strange how I don't question whether I'm into men when, one, I've never dated men, two, I've never been sexually involved with men, but I doubt these same things when it comes to women. And it's just going back to compulsory heterosexuality, like, I don't give myself the same,
like the freedom or the space to explore that?
Yeah. I don't give myself the same level of freedom. And yeah, it's strange how it's just sort of like the default mode of living. Like, everything is just so heteronormative, and it's hard to live in a way that contradicts that. So yeah, there's some really great points that really make you reflect. Like, some of the statements that the Master Doc includes is like, I like the idea of being with a man, but anytime a man makes a move on me, I get incredibly uncomfortable. And like, when I read that, I was like, I can sort of relate. Wait, like, I really need to think about this. And then, you know, you mistake the desire for male approval as attraction. You don't necessarily want a relationship with men, but you want men to want a relationship with you. And that, yeah, I feel like this Master Doc could really make people spiral. And it's definitely not like fully comprehensive. Like, it's not super open or like inclusive of bisexual people. It's specifically a Master Doc for asking if you are a lesbian. And there's definitely a bit of bi erasure there, because, you know, you might confuse that your compulsory heterosexuality with, like, you might think it's compulsory heterosexuality, but maybe you're just bi. So there's definitely some issues with the Master Doc, but I think it's a really good starting point to thinking about your sexuality if you are questioning if you're lesbian or just not straight. And
definitely like to see this adapted to like other contexts, like for gay people or for bis.
Yeah, it's very good to have these sort of resources. Go ahead.
I was just gonna jump on to like the process of you coming out, you mentioned like I guess somewhat going back into the closet in some aspects when it came to your parents and accepting that part of your queerness. And I was wondering if that has intersected with other aspects of your identity, like being Black in Vancouver, or how it intersects with you as a woman when maybe performing roles for your parents in that aspect. Like, how is the intersectionalities played out there?
Oh my goodness, yes. I definitely thought about this, and I feel like it's a lot to be a Black woman, and it's a whole lot more to be a queer Black woman. So living with these identities is living with a lot of layers of oppression. So it's you're accepting your sexuality, but you're also accepting the fact that you might be exposed to a lot of violence, a lot of disapproval, that your existence is uncomfortable to a lot of people. And yeah, it's not an easy thing to take on. It's definitely scary. But again, to live authentically, like, you have to be okay with that possibility. Like, your need to be liberated has to be greater than your fear. And that is definitely the case for me. And even though I sort of go in and out of being okay with my queerness, I know that eventually I will reach a point where I'm just fully my queer Black female self, who is just unafraid of how that might be seen or taken as.
I wanna hop on top of something you mentioned with, I also want to talk about parents. I don't know why my inclination is to talk about parents. There's probably a lot of trauma going on there. When you mentioned the seeing a therapist, I've actually personally been trying to see a therapist myself. Mm. It's just so hard recently, but I know there's like a lot of resources available to students right now.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you thought if that was, one, something you shared with your parents, and two, if it was easy to access a therapist for these specific concerns, you know, like your identity as a queer.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, it definitely was not easy. My first therapist was a white woman, mm-hmm. and that definitely made it a lot difficult for me to feel heard and understood, mm-hmm. for my unique experience to be really known and acknowledged in a way that was validating. So I think it's definitely important to have a therapist that understands where you're coming from, who is ideally of the same ethnicity as you. Because now I have a Black therapist, and it has been such a game changer. Like, it's a different level of trust and safety that I didn't have when I had a white therapist. So I think there's definitely a need for more for therapists that are of different ethnic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. There are definitely not enough Black therapists out there. Like, I had to make a specific request when I was in search of a therapist. Like, they have to be Black. Like, I can't put myself through that and put myself through having a white therapist. So therapy needs to be catered to the needs of people. And I definitely felt a bit like I'm comfortable with having to, you know, assert that. Like, it can seem a bit like, well, it's already hard to get good mental health service. Like, for you to demand that your therapist is of the same background as you is just, you know.
I don't think that's a large ask, honestly. Yeah. Like,
at first I thought that, and it's not, it's really not. So I really want to encourage people to ask for what they need. Like, you're paying for it, and you know, it's going to affect your therapy experience. So
that's some money right there too, right? Yeah. Like, if it's not through UBC or like the provincial health services that are offered during COVID, so much money. And I am a poor student.
Yes.
Santa Ono, give me
all
of the therapy sessions, like, honestly.
Yeah, UBC can definitely do a better job at catering to its students. Like, the mental health service that we have access to is not good and it needs to be improved.
Did you go through UBC to seek a therapist yourself?
yeah, at first that's where I had my white therapist, but then my black therapist, at first I found her through Aspiria, which is this mental health service connector in a way. And that's where it started. But then I kept seeing her outside of that Aspiria program and start paying more out of pocket. But it's definitely been worth it. Like, I trust my therapist 100%, and she has helped me so much in just understanding my traumas and just becoming more and more liberated who I am.
And that's so honestly so important. Like when we talk about seeking out a person of color as your therapist from like your ethnic background, I think it's so important. Because for my ethnic group in particular, there's so much like colonialism involved that I'm not sure how to open up that conversation with like a white therapist. And I reflect on that a lot, and how a lot of that has to do with a lack of representation of BIPOC people in academia. And it brings me to like dismantling whitewashing of history, dismantling like the ways in which like white academia has been overpowering in like in the academy. And I was wondering, do you feel like this overwriting or whitewashing of queer history has been a factor and maybe the struggle of coming out as a queer Black person? Because I'm Filipino, and when I was coming out to my parents, I was giving them all the brochures that were written by white people, but they never contextualized that within the context of like the Philippines and our history and how queer it really was. So do you feel like the overwriting and whitewashing of queer history has impacted you in a large, surmountable way?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of whitewashing in academia and queer history. Personally, I'm still learning about queer history, and a course that has really helped me in that has been a starting point is Sociology of Sexualities. It's Soci 369 at UBC, and the professor I had was Becky Ross, and she is an amazing queer woman. She's retiring, so you likely won't have her if you choose to take the course, but I highly recommend it because the papers that she would assign to us were very multifaceted, it covered a wide range of experiences as a queer person. And some of the papers I read really challenged my understanding of queerness and being queer and Black. Like, I read a paper on Black queer women who engage in pornography. I read about race play and how some Black women enjoy that. So it really contributed to expanding my understanding of sexuality and how, you know, there's so much that I don't know. There's so much that people engage in that I might not necessarily understand, but that is a part of, you know, the queer experience. So Sociology of Sexualities is an amazing course. And
are you telling me you look forward to a paper in this class?
Yes. Generally all the papers are so interesting, and some of them were specific to Vancouver, like learning about sex workers history in Vancouver, learning about just the queer scene in Vancouver, designing like queer pop-ups, and it was an amazing course. So if you're looking for a starting point, and you are at UBC, I recommend
take this course while you can, folks. You touched on Vancouver in that last part about queer pop-ups, and I think I should finish off this interview with asking you what's one thing you would change about Vancouver, whether it be like policy or an aspect of the built environment or even the representation, like we were talking about in academia. What would you change in Vancouver, and why, so that it would cater to your experience?
That's a bit hard to answer since I'm very much new to the queer scene as a baby queer. But when it comes to UBC specifically, I would love to see courses, more interesting courses maybe within, specifically within the arts department, that are more intersectional, like similar to sociology of sexualities, where you can really explore different identities and how those combine into unique experiences. Like, I would love to have a queer Black female professor teach me something. Like, that yes. would be so cool. And just having a more diverse staff and courses that make students feel seen, I think, is really important in affirming someone's sexuality or someone's amalgamation of identities. And I think that's really important. And within Vancouver, the only thing I can think of is having just safe spaces for Black queer people at the heart of Vancouver, like not just like a centralized areas like
Davie Street. Oh my gosh, that's not always accessible, or those spaces like equitable
yeah.
people. And it's also like not the only place where like queer people live. Like, I guess they all assume we just live on Davie. If you're queer, you live on Davie or something.
Yeah, just seeing Black queer people in spaces that are normally occupied by non-Black, non-queer people, I think would be great.
Also, you bring up like the like having profs that represent you, and I think that's really interesting. And I've been thinking somewhat a lot about like the hiring policy and how like sometimes when they're hiring a professor, they just essentially check off a box if they're marginalized or not. And it's like, no, that is not, it's not how it works. You have to like make sure that everyone is equally represented, and it's not just this person is marginalized, and so like we checked all of what BIPOC people are asking for. Anyway, thank you so much, Marylise. I really appreciate the interview today. I was speaking to Marylise Habiyambre, UBC student, psych student. Look out for that soci class. Thank you so much, Marylise.
No problem. Thank you.